Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
This is the Sunday morning wake-up call. It is not Rick Moore. This is Sean McCord in a pre-recorded episode on a, what today is a fine sunny Sunday morning. We'll see what it's like when we broadcast. My guest today is Kara McClurkin, who is my friend, my neighbor, my coworker, and someone who has an interesting and informative family story to tell. Kara, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It is such a pleasure. And I think when people hear what it is that we have to talk about, they, like me, will admire your courage for coming on the air and talking about something that has affected your family. And that is, well, you're wearing a T-shirt right now that my radio audience can't see, but your T-shirt says, "I love someone who is SMA-zing," with a big exclamation point. And SMA stands for, you tell me.
Spinal muscular atrophy.
Spinal muscular atrophy. And this is a disease that many people might not have heard of, but you and your family has become very well acquainted with in the past 5 years.
Right. So I had never heard of it until about 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Spinal muscular atrophy is the most common of the rare diseases. It affects between 1 in 6 to 1 in 10,000 births in the United States, and 1 in 40 of us are carriers for this disease.
Those are astonishing numbers for a disease that many of us have never heard of.
Right. And that's one of the things that those of us who have someone affected by SMA is trying to change, is to let people know about this disease so that they can be tested before they have children, so that if they have results that suggest that they might have a 1 in 4 chance of having a child with SMA, if both parents have are carriers, then we just want them to be informed. And there's hope now in a way that there wasn't before, because there is some treatment and there is more testing on the way. And the earlier that children affected with SMA are identified and are able to get access to treatment, then the better their prognosis.
Just in the past few years, just since your son was diagnosed, because I've been talking to you and I've been keeping track of the changes in medicine that have taken place. So you have two children, and your older child, your daughter, is so far has not exhibited any signs of SMA.
That is true. We haven't had her tested. We will have her tested when she's a teenager, before she needs to make some decisions about parenting and that sort of thing.
Sure.
Because she needs to be informed, but she does not show any symptoms. My guess is there's a 50-50 chance that she's a carrier. So she probably is either a carrier or she is what's known as unaffected. So the way the genetics work out is that if each parent is missing one of these genes, it's SMN1, then they can function just fine with only one of them. But if you know your genetics, you know that, you know, there are sort of two options, and the way the game of roulette goes is that there's a 1 in 4 chance that your child will be completely unaffected. There's a 2 in 4 chance that they will, like you, be carriers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a 1 in 4 chance that they will not have either SMN1 gene, and therefore they will be diagnosed with spinal muscular atrophy.
And that's what happened with your son, Bennett,
who's
now 5 years old.
So when he was born, he was perfectly healthy on all the scales. There was no concern. Although in looking back, he was a very different baby than my daughter. And if I wasn't so adamant about not trying to compare my children, perhaps I would have seen some of the signs earlier than I did. Because Bennett is actually diagnosed fairly late for the severity of SMA that he has. He is officially diagnosed as SMA type 1. That mostly means that he has never been able to sit up on his own.
Mm-hmm.
But usually type 1 children are diagnosed in the first 6 months of life. And he was almost a year. In fact, he was a year before he was diagnosed officially.
Well, I wouldn't be too hard on yourself, because this is a condition, and as you said, people aren't aware of. And of course, parents want to treat all their children as individuals. But you and I have talked about this before, but can you tell us about how the diagnosis came about?
He is a May baby. And so his 6-month checkup, actually, we didn't talk at all about any concerns that, you know, you check off the boxes. Has this child rolled over? Well, he had mm-hmm. rolled over, not as much, certainly not as much as his sister, but he had, you know, had he pushed up, you know, on his arms. Well, I have one picture of that when he was at my mom's house when he was 4 months old. So okay. I checked the boxes. Yes, he has. And we spent most of our 6-month checkup talking about other things. And but at Christmas, his godfather said to me, he was holding Bennett, and said, "Wow, Bennett's, you know, his skin is really cold." I mean, it was December, so that's not unusual. Mm-hmm. But one of the symptoms or one of the conditions that happen with SMA is sometimes the patients with SMA can't regulate their body temperature as well as the rest of us, so that in the wintertime they can get very cold, and in the summertime they can overheat really easily. So that was something that was different, and I thought about it, and I was like, "Huh, you're right. He gets really cold in the winter time."
Yeah.
And so that was sort of one thing. But I didn't really think that much about it. I just thought, well, you know, I don't have great circulation. Maybe he doesn't have great circulation either.
Sure.
And then it was actually at his cousin's birthday party. And his cousin's other grandmother was holding Bennett. And at this point, he was about 8 months old. And she is a nurse. And she said to me, she's like, "You know, Bennett's muscles he's not supporting himself very well." And it was like this light bulb went off in my head, like something I had known for a very long time. And it's just like I needed somebody to say it out loud. And I just knew right then and there that something was very, very, very wrong.
Yeah.
And so the next Monday actually was, it was MLK weekend, so of course the doctor's office wasn't open. Mm. But Tuesday morning I made an appointment to see the doctor, and I just said I thought that my son had some delays, and we got in fairly quickly. And the doctor took one look at Bennett, and she actually burst into tears.
Wow. So let's talk about SMA. Step away from Bennett for a moment. Let's talk about SMA so that people who are listening maybe can get a better idea. What is SMA, and what are the symptoms? And then we can circle around back to how did they diagnose this in your son?
So the gene SMN1 is the one that regulates the motor neurons, and is the primary one that regulates the motor neurons. It's what tells them to fire. And I will say that I am not a scientist, and I am not as well versed in this as someone who probably understands the science behind it.
Of course.
But Bennett is missing the primary gene that helps his muscle motor neurons fire and stay alive. And mm-hmm. that over time, there is a backup gene that's called SMN2, but it doesn't work nearly as efficiently. And SMN2 actually, there's pieces missing from that gene, and so it's not complete. In general, the more copies of SMN2 that folks with SMA have, in general, the better they are, because they can compensate a little bit better.
Okay.
And in general, the less copies they have, they function even less well. Over time, what happens is the muscle motor neurons begin to die. And folks with SMA, especially the more severe type, start to lose abilities to move. With kids like Bennett, who has SMA type 1, they will eventually lose their ability to swallow, and eventually lose their ability to breathe.
So, again, you're not a medical expert, but you've learned a whole lot about this in the past few years. You've mentioned that he's SMA 1. So what are the different categories?
And there's a couple variations to this, but the primary categories are SMA 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, kids with SMA 1 are diagnosed within the first 6 months, and sort of the thing that is the identifying characteristic is that they never learn to sit up on their own.
Mm.
Kids with SMA type 2 sit up on their own maybe even start crawling, but they never get to a point where they can walk unassisted, and they may lose their ability to sit over time. Mm-hmm. And folks with type 3 have learned to walk, and they may or may not lose their ability to walk over time. Most of the time, they do eventually lose their ability to walk. But type 3 patients tend to live a normal lifespan. They just lose a lot of their functioning over time. Type 2 tend to, in the past at least, lived into their late teens, early 20s to adolescence in general, although certainly there are examples of folks who have lived a lot longer. And with type 1, when he was diagnosed, 90% of kids with type 1 didn't make it past the age of 2.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember we talked about that at the time, and it bears repeating. Bennett just turned 5.
He did just turn 5.
We'll circle around it. We'll work up to the medicines now and the progress that's been made. But I want to talk a little bit more about how Bennett was diagnosed.
So that was a really emotionally draining, scary, frustrating process.
Yeah.
It took many, many months. As it turns out, the pediatrician, the one who saw him that day in January, SMA was on her list of one of the possible things it could be. But it certainly was not the first thing that was tested. He had so many tests in those months. We had muscle biopsies, and we had an MRI, and we had tons of blood work done. You know, we went to see the neurologist, and they didn't at all mention SMA. We went and, you know, had muscle biopsies and MRIs, and you know, they could say, yeah, his muscles are not developing well. He has something called hypertonia. But we don't, they still didn't know what the cause of it was. Eventually, we got sent to a geneticist. And all of these things are expensive. Like, we have great insurance, and the copays coming in was just overwhelming.
Yeah.
And we were having to make some decisions, especially when we went to the geneticist, because a lot of times insurance companies won't pay for the genetic work. Or if they did, they had 30 days to appeal, and we were, you know, we were trying to figure out what it was right then and there. So I actually remember sitting in the geneticist's office and calling my in-laws and asking them if they could help us with a $1,700 bill for a specific test that someone was asking for, because we just didn't have that.
Yeah.
SMA was not one of the things that the geneticist tested first in the first round. In fact, there were some other things that came up that turned out to be inconsequential, but we didn't know that at the time. So some sort of red herrings that came up, some other abnormalities in his genetic code, which we all have.
Sure.
And even in the second round, she wasn't going to pull SMA. she wasn't going to test it. She's like, it's a $300 test just in and of itself. And what I said to her was, actually, no, I need you to do that one, because I've been researching all these possible things you're telling me he might have, and that's the one I can't handle. Like, that's the one with the most difficult diagnosis and the most serious diagnosis, and I can't. Emotionally, I just need to cross that one off the list. So $300 seems like a small price to pay to cross that off the list. And so she did in that second round. She went ahead and added the SMA to the panel of tests that she was doing.
And these are all genetic tests.
They were genetic tests. Yeah. You know, with the muscle biopsy, at one point they thought he might have infantile botulism. That was a potential diagnosis at one point, which is serious. It certainly could kill your child. But if you survive it, actually, there's the you tend to do okay. So actually, at one point, that sounded kind of nice. as it turns out, that's not what he had. And so I was, we went into the doctor's office in January. He had his first birthday, and we still didn't know. That was, 4 months later. And I was sitting in my office one day, and the phone rang, and I picked it up. It was a crazy busy day, and I, sort of was only half paying attention to who was on the other end of the line. And it was the genetic counselor, and she had the results, and that's how I found out.
That's when you found out. Now, how did, I'm talking to Kara McClurkin. We were talking about SMA, spinal muscular atrophy, and how your family has had to learn so much about this. So how did SMA first get on your radar? Was it the one of the initial doctors who suggested it, or did you come across it while you were researching and its symptoms, or do you remember?
I don't remember. You know, I do remember looking back at sort of the notes from that doctor's visit in January, and SMA was one of the things she was worried about, but I didn't like stay on my radar. It was certainly one of the things we talked about. We talked about a whole range of muscular dystrophies and other things. And so like I had this notebook and I would just write down everything and all the words that the doctors and the various specialists were throwing at us. And then I would go home and I would spend some time looking them up, trying to understand what was going on in between, in between doctor's appointments.
Yeah. You mentioned muscular dystrophy. I think that is a disease more people are familiar with. As at least when I was growing up, they used to have a telethon once a year. Do they still have that?
SMA is actually, it fits under the umbrella of muscular dystrophy,
right?
But it is different enough, and that the SMA community has, while we certainly work with the muscular dystrophy community, they also, the SMA community, because it was such a rare disease, knew that they needed, if they wanted the disease to get the attention that they felt that it needed for their children, they had to sort of separate themselves or become independently work to advocate for treatments and medicines. And they actually have done a remarkably fantastic job of raising funds to do preliminary research. It's the SMA community that often funds the preliminary research for SMA. And then when it looks like a treatment might be viable, you know, then a drug company will pick it up, or then there might be a grant from the NIH or something like that. But the challenge with rare diseases is that there's so few people who have them. From a drug company's perspective, there isn't as much of a potential market as something that is more prevalent.
Yeah.
And so it's a higher risk to them in terms of payout.
Yeah, and we'll get back to drug companies and treatment in a little bit, but I kind of want to step through what your family had to go through. So when Bennett was finally officially diagnosed, he said he was like 16 months?
He was 12. He was 12 and a half.
Oh, excuse me. All right. I got my timeline wrong there. And suddenly you found yourself an SMA family. And you've mentioned several times about the SMA community. How did you go from being an SMA family to a member of the SMA community?
So I have to say, I was really grateful. The neurologist that we first met with, he trained at Boston Children's Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knew that there was a neuromuscular clinic there that was quite good. And so even before we had the diagnosis, he had connected us to that, to Boston Children's. And so we had an appointment. And in fact, once he was diagnosed, you know, they're like, well, you don't have to go up there now that you know what he has. And I was like, no. I think it's all the more important that I have to go up there. I have to go talk to people who know.
Yep. Yet you're making trips up to Boston.
Yeah. So we make trips up there twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Boston Children's who really connected us to the larger SMA community. There's a couple of them. Cure SMA is the largest. When he was diagnosed, it went by a different name. I think it went, but it was SMA, Families of Spinal Muscular Atrophy, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they do everything from send care packages to the families full of toys that kids with SMA can handle and lift and use. There are folks out there who send blankets to the newly diagnosed. Mm. There is a conference every year, and the newly diagnosed families get a scholarship both for the conference itself and for the hotel. And that going and attending the conference was really very informative. And I met a lot of people there. There's a Virginia chapter of Cure SMA. And so we do fundraising together. And so I get to see those folks at least once a year. And just because there's a handful of families in Central Virginia that have kids with SMA, but there's not a ton of us.
My guest is Kara McClurkin. We are talking about SMA on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. This is Sean McCord on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. I'm sitting with my friend and neighbor, Kara McClurkin, and we're talking about your son, Bennett, and how you found yourselves, as a family, having to deal with a disease that, before Bennett was born, you had never even heard of. And just to be clear on this, because you talked about this is a genetic condition, and give me those numbers again.
So 1 in 40 is the average that are carriers, like my husband and I are. And the numbers come out, it depends how you look at it, but between 1 in 6,000 and 1 in 10,000 babies are born with this disease. It's the number one genetic killer of children under 2.
That's amazing. And yet, although you were both carriers, this had never come up in your family before, never come up in your husband's family. It was just a toss of the genetic dice, and your first child, your daughter, hasn't exhibited any signs of this. You haven't had the genetic test yet, and yet with Bennett, it became within a short year, it became clear that there was something going on here. Now let's talk a little bit about SMA itself. I want to go back a bit more to the symptoms. You said that it's you're missing a genetic marker. That's a neurotransmitter that helps you control your muscles, both consciously and unconsciously, your muscles that operate without conscious effort. So how does it exhibit physically as somebody with SMA gets older?
So they begin to lose the ability to use their muscles the way the rest of us do.
Mm-hmm.
For example, my son has trouble holding his neck up. You lose your ability to walk for sure. Some of them never do, like my son will probably never walk.
Yeah.
You have trouble even doing things like eating and, even breathing. You know, if you think about it, the lungs are in fact a muscle.
Sure.
Swallowing, talking. Sometimes that takes a lot of muscle and a lot of effort. It doesn't affect cognitive function at all.
Right.
In fact, folks with SMA often exhibit higher than average intelligence levels. But over time, the most severe cases, you are basically trapped in a body in which you cannot control. But they say that, you know, SMA is like ALS, but for children.
Wow. So you said there are a few families here in Virginia, but none other in Charlottesville. Do you remember that, right?
I don't believe there is anyone else in Charlottesville. There are some in the surrounding areas.
Yeah.
Yes.
So as you started connecting to these families through Cure SMA is a group that was introduced to you at Boston Children's Hospital. When you first started connecting to these families, I mean, what was it like? What kind of? I mean, you all had children who had the same condition. Were you trading, you know, tips on how to care for each other, or did it sort of immediately plunge into cures? And I should, you know, it's we had to point this out because it will come up as soon as we start talking about medicine and healthcare. It gets very political. How did your communications with these families first establish themselves?
So there's several Facebook groups that are focused on different things. There's there's a general support one. There is one for families that want to do what they call non-invasive ventilation, which is helping kids breathe in a way that doesn't involve tracking them. There's a group for kids who are trached. There are different groups for adapting toys for kids who have SMA.
Mm.
There are groups for different diets.
Sure.
The thing you have to remember is that every kid is different, and the trajectory of and grownups too. There are in fact many grownups with SMA.
Sure.
So I tend to use kids because my child is still a kid. And so some of it was like online and more coming up with coping strategies, better understanding the various therapies and how they help slow down the progression of the disease. And some of it was just being in, when we went to the conference, it was both humbling and scary and inspiring, all of those things, to see kids whose conditions had progressed, to, who were more advanced in the seriousness of it than what Bennett was, and to sort of look into the future and think that could be my child's future. I met and was connected to sort of emotionally. A woman was sitting next to me and found out that her child had just passed away a few months before. And she was someone who lived in Virginia, in Northern Virginia. And, you know, that is very much part of the community, as well as all of the families who have lost their children, and their children have lost their fight against SMA. So there was the, you know, trying to support and to deal with all of that. A lot of my friends don't know children who have died. And there are times where, because of the connection of social media, I know of multiple deaths from SMA in a week, and that can get totally and completely overwhelming.
Yeah, of course.
On the other hand, when somebody is in the hospital and they're in the hospital in a place where they maybe are less familiar with SMA, the community sort of rallies and can help them get the right equipment and get the right settings and make sure that they have what they need. So Bennett has been hospitalized a couple times, and I've learned some things from that, from the community, and how better to prepare him for those situations. Because I know of other people going through similar things.
Okay. Take a drink. My guest is Kara McClurkin. We're talking about SMA, spinal muscular atrophy. And Kara, you mentioned different treatments. And I know that there are going to be different treatments for different people with a condition, because everybody is different. But can you talk about some of the treatments that you've gone through with Bennett?
So when Bennett was first diagnosed, there were no treatments. The closest thing to a treatment was, I think, there was the use of liquid albuterol, which I sort of think of as caffeine for the muscles. But it really wasn't a treatment, but it does help give them a little extra strength. And so with Bennett going to school full time, you know, he takes some liquid albuterol, and that helps give him a little more. Like I said, I think of it as caffeine for the muscles. But there wasn't any. And in fact, when he was diagnosed, I said, what type is he? And they're like, well, we think he's probably a type one. And I knew what that meant. I knew that, you know, 90% of kids with type one were dead by the time they were two. And they said, well, he's a strong type one. And they were like, in my experience, he has 1 to 5 years. And, you know, what do you do with that?
Yeah.
What do you do with that when you're in a room and you're holding your precious baby, and they tell you basically to take him home and love him, and that at least you're lucky because he probably would live long enough for him to tell you that he loved you. Well, first of all, I wasn't willing to take that for an answer.
No.
Part of the reason I went to Boston, even though we already had a diagnosis, was because I wanted to know everything I could do.
Yes.
And so some of the therapies, I would not call it treatment, but the therapies we do for Bennett, he spends 8 hours a day in various therapies. He has two rounds of respiratory therapy he goes through when he's well, and he goes through more rounds of it when he's sick. He uses a saline nebulizer to try and loosen up any congestion he has in his lungs. And then he uses a piece of equipment called the vest, which is used in the treatment of cystic fibrosis patients. It basically shakes his lungs to try and get anything that's in there loose.
This is the respiratory part of the respiratory theory. In is he trached?
He is not trached. And then there's a machine called a cough assist that forces air in and out of his lungs to try and sort of pull up whatever it is that they've shaken loose. And so he does that twice a day, even when he's well. And when he's sick, he does it many, many more times. And that's about a 30 to 45 minute process he does multiple times a day. He then has various physical therapies that he does to try and minimize the effects of not being able to walk and his muscle and his scoliosis that has been developed from not being able to hold his body in alignment. And so he does, he has special AFOs that are shoes that he...
AFOs?
I forget what they stand for, but they're orthotics that help him, that sort of help his feet, support his feet so that he can, and he's placed in a piece of equipment called a stander, which actually allows him to stand upright, which is not something he's able to do on his own. He wears something called a TLSO, which is we call his vest, which it provides some structural support to his upper body, which tries and slows down the scoliosis and also helps him breathe a little bit better because, you know, it helps his hold his body upright. He's his legs are constricting more and more significantly as time goes on, which means they're more and more bent. They don't straighten out like ours.
Sure.
And so he wears leg braces for several hours a day that try and counteract that. His hip is displaced. It's actually permanently out of alignment and will eventually need surgery. But for the moment, we put him in a hip brace for several hours a day to try and relieve some of the pain and the pressure from that condition. So those are all therapies that he does to try and both ease his comfort and slow down the progression of the disease. But there are many drugs in the pipeline. I forget the numbers. There's been, I don't know, 20 or 30 of them that the SMA community has helped fund over the years. And some of them have been eliminated and it's discovered it has not been helpful. But on December 23rd of last year, 2016, the FDA approved the very first treatment for spinal muscular atrophy in the United States. And actually, Europe just approved it this past week.
It's amazing.
It's the generic name of the drug, I believe, is nusinersen. The product that we all know it by is Spinraza. And it is injected into the spinal column because it doesn't pass the blood barrier. And it has to be done on a regular basis. And so these kids get lumbar punctures, or adults. They're adults getting this treatment as well. And the goal of the... It doesn't cure. It doesn't fix the genetic disorder.
Sure.
But it does bind to the SMN2s and helps them work a little more efficiently for the duration that the medicine works. And then they have to get it again. And the goal of the treatment was to stop the progression of the disease. But in fact, it has done much better than that.
Well, you tell me about that. And I can see you light up when you say that.
So it's miraculous. I'm not sure that the average person can understand what it's like to have a child who... whose muscles don't work, like who can't, not only can they not just pick up and run around, but who needs you to do everything, to feed him and to change his clothes and to adjust his head. And he can raise his arm now, like he can raise his hand like a regular kid.
Yeah.
And I used to have to, if I wanted to hug him, I would have to take his hands and I would have to wrap them around the back of my neck while we were lying down together and sort of simulate what a hug should be like.
Mm-hmm.
And the other night he said to me, he goes, "Mommy, I can squeeze you so tight."
Oh.
I still have to help him sometimes get his arms around me, but I can feel the pressure. That's amazing.
In this, since he started the
Spinraza. Nusinersen, at the end of January, beginning of February.
And how long has Bennett been taking this?
So his first dose, I'm trying to remember, I think it was the beginning of February.
Yeah.
And they get four, what they call loading doses. And Bennett actually was fairly sick during that time period. And so we didn't get it in the exact order. You're supposed to get 4 loading doses on day 1, day 15, day 30, and day 60. And he ended up, his 4th dose was about a month behind where it should have been. Hmm. But he's now had all his loading doses. And so he'll go from loading doses to maintenance doses. And so he'll get that injection in his spine once every 4 months for the rest of his life, probably, until...
Yeah.
Or unless something else comes along.
So this treatment, as you said, was the original thought would abate the progress of the disease. But you're telling me that you and other people are surprised to learn that it's actually making things better, not just slowing things down.
Right. It's making things better. Again, every child is different. It seems to be that the earlier the child gets access to the treatment, the better it is. So there are type 1 babies who are actually learning to walk, which is a miracle.
I just answered the question I was going to ask. It was how young they can start taking this. So you have heard of babies who are now actually with Bennett's condition, are actually learning to walk.
Yeah, they were part of the original drug trial. But yes, they are learning to walk. Bennett probably won't be able to because he didn't get it until he was almost 5. And he has the most severe type, or he has type 1. There's another type called type 0, but which those children are very, very severe and rarely live very long. But yeah, the earlier you get it, but even older adults are getting access to the drug now as well. There's a young woman I follow. She's in her 20s. She has type 1 like Bennett does. And she often is the person I turn to when I'm feeling depressed and down about this condition because she's this amazing young woman who is working on advocating for raising funds for SMA. And she got her treatment a couple months actually ahead of Bennett, and she has noticed changes too. So even someone in their 20s with the condition like Bennett has, she has noticed her voice is stronger.
Wow.
And she had lost some of her abilities to use their computer and that sort of thing, which was really hard on her. But she's noticing changes too. So even with older patients, they are finding that it is making a tremendous difference.
And you mentioned, I'm going to go back a little bit, when they took the test on Bennett and were able to diagnose that he did indeed have SMA. You said, and the doctors told you that he probably had SMA1. So the genetic test won't tell you necessarily what kind of SMA it is. That has to be proven in how it exhibits itself in the particular patient.
Right.
Right. So we're going to take a break in just a moment. But for families that are just now dealing with this, who are just now learning about SMA in their own, let's speculate, infant children. What do you recommend? What's the first thing you recommend as a resource?
Finding a site that gives, that does this procedure, this Spinraza injection. I mean, I think that getting access to the drug as soon as possible, I mean, it clearly shows it makes a huge difference. But also just not to give up hope. I mean, there's no good time to be diagnosed with SMA,
right.
But we really are in a moment where there is so much hope. And we are working, we're advocating for all newborns to be screened for SMA so that coming out of the hospital, like you would know, right?
Right.
And you could, maybe before you leave the hospital, you could have this injection. And so we knew, I mean, if like I said, there's a 50% chance that our daughter is a carrier. If we had tested her, found out she was a carrier, that would have helped us be better prepared,
sure,
for understanding what our family was up against. So for other families newly diagnosed, it's a great time to be diagnosed. B, there is this whole community out there. C, while your life will change tremendously, you will discover there is so much love and support and caring people in the universe. I mean, that is a sort of a lesson I have learned and discovered as a part of this process, and they will too.
My guest is Karen McClurkin. This is Sean McCord on WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. And we're back. This is Sean McCord on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. My guest, Karen McClurkin. We've been talking about SMA, spinal muscular atrophy. Your son, your five-year-old son, Bennett, was diagnosed about 4 years ago, a little over 4 years ago. And you said your groups are advocating for just genetic testing of all babies when they're born. Are you also advocating for genetic testing of parents or of couples before they become parents?
Absolutely. You know, when you are thinking about having a child, and certainly when you're pregnant, there's a slew of tests that you can take.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were certain ones that I knew I wanted to take. And some I deliberately chose not to because I said it wouldn't affect any choices I made or any outcome. But I had been exposed to some kids who had some pretty severe diseases, and I felt like I needed to know if I was a carrier for those things. And so I got tested for them. And there's actually lots of, they can do all sorts of things. There's all sorts of options, including nothing, right? And just letting nature take its course and rolling the dice. And that is an absolutely, completely appropriate decision. But there are ways to test the fertilized eggs before they're implanted. There are tests to test early on in pregnancy, you know, and you can do all sorts of things with that. So you can be better prepared. So you can go find a site where they're doing treatment. You just having more knowledge, is really important. I went ahead and my brother got tested, right? Because I wanted him to know, because if he was a carrier, then his children needed to get tested.
That's
my
right.
Uncle got tested, so that my cousins. And the good news in my family is that I'm the only one that that is a carrier. My mother and I, yeah.
Right.
I felt like they needed to know that. They needed to have those.
Absolutely.
Have that knowledge. What they choose to do with it is absolutely their business. But I wish I had known.
I wish you had even heard of this
right
beforehand.
You know, the conditions and the diseases I had heard of, I had already made some informed decisions about when I was choosing to have a family.
Yeah.
And I think it doesn't hurt any of us to be armed with the knowledge.
So, we've talked about the SMA community, but as with any community, people are different, families are different, patients are different. Are there different approaches, within the communities on treatments and diagnoses?
Sure. Absolutely. And that can be hard, trying to make sure that we provide a safe space where everybody feels like their opinions and their personal beliefs are valued.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, they want to keep their child alive no matter what, no matter how invasive the treatments are. And that is absolutely their right. There are others who at some point make a decision to let nature take its course, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when Bennett was diagnosed, we were given a piece of paper, which I do not carry, I will admit, that basically has his diagnosis and tells an emergency room not to treat him the same way they would treat and another person coming through, that to check with us first before beginning, you know, crazy life-saving, absolutely all extremes.
Sure.
No parent should have to have a letter like that, although I understand why it was given to me. I choose not to keep it with me. And one could argue that's not a good plan, but that's the choice I've made, right? But my physicians wanted to give me that option so that if we chose not, say we didn't want him to be trached, or we didn't want, you know, that, because getting off of that is a lot more complicated.
Of course.
And over the years, we've had some scary moments. When Bennett had his first treatment, it was complicated, and they were still figuring out some protocols. And there was a series of events that happened in which Bennett ended up in the PICU for 4 days. And at one point, he was
PICU is the
pediatric intensive care unit. And his oxygen levels were dropping down so low that at one point they talked about having to intubate him in order to keep his lungs functioning. Mm. We were having to have this conversation, a really difficult conversation to have. Given the direction it looked like it was going, it was like either we're going to have to intubate, or we're going to have to see, you know, let nature take its course and see what happens.
Yeah.
And, that's a really terrible position to be in.
But you find support in the communities for wherever a family is, they're going to find people who'll be able to support the decisions they're making.
Right. And some folks would say absolutely intubate no matter what.
Right.
And other people would say, well, let's look at everything else that's going on in this child. And you know, how long has that child been fighting, and how long, you know, and nobody can make that decision for another family or another child.
Of course not. And I imagine, I mean, a family dealing with what you're dealing with, you're having to make decisions all the time. There's no handbook here. You kind of have to go with what seems right for you and your family.
And the decisions I make today may not have been the decisions I would have made 4 years ago,
or the
decisions I'll make 3 years from now. What most of us try to do is be as respectful as possible, because the last thing you want to do in the event of somebody's crisis is to tell them that the choices they're making are poor ones.
Yeah.
But this is, it can be complicated. And there definitely have been situations where families have not felt as supported as they could have been, because people were trying their best to advocate what they thought was right. But, you know, there's always sort of this reminder of trying to be respectful for everyone and their beliefs, and to let them, you know, every family has to make their own decision about what's best for their kid.
You talked about going up to Boston Children's Hospital, meeting specialists up there, but you don't live in Boston, you live in Charlottesville. So have you found doctors here in Charlottesville who are equipped to deal with the challenges that your family has?
We've been so lucky.
Yeah.
And I don't know how we were hooked up with our developmental pediatrician. I really do think there was some sort of divine something, because I've never figured out who recommended. There were so many appointments flying left and right in that spring of his diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And I have yet to figure out who actually referred us to her. But she has been an advocate for Bennett and for the kids with SMA. It's not even in her research area.
You can say your doctor's name if you like.
It's Dr. Scharf. She's amazing, and she just has been this amazing advocate for these kids. You know, she goes all over the world, and I think her research area is like nutrition and the effects of poor nutrition. And if I get that wrong, Dr. Scharf, I'm sorry. but she has taken these kids on, and she's the one who has organized the treatment at UVA. Most places, it's the neurology department that does it, but at UVA, mm-hmm. it's developmental pediatrics. And she went in, you know, so the FDA approved the drug on the 23rd of December, and she came into work on the 24th of December on Christmas Eve. She went into work to start this process, and she's amazing. And she just kept fighting for our kids. And
so you're saying kids, so she has more than one patient now.
There are more than one, yeah. I'm not sure if Bennett was her. Bennett wasn't her first kid with SMA, but because I know because we talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
But she has a group of them now.
So that actually was one of my questions. Does Bennett have friends who have SMA, or at least other children that he's met?
He certainly has met them, and in the treatment, you know, there's patient privacy, right? But but on the day of, they tend to cluster the injections. You know, they do several of them at a time,
mm-hmm.
and so we have been fortunate enough to meet the other kids in the recovery room.
Yeah.
And you know, again, you have to worry. There's this little bit of patient privacy going on where one parent says to the nurse, "Hey, can you go ask the parents of the other patient if we can say hello?" Or, you know, you're walking by their room anyway on your way out the door. And so we have, that's not the best of circumstances to meet someone.
Mm-hmm.
But we have met several of the other families. And in fact, UVA had one gathering that they've gotten together of the local kids with neuromuscular disorders, and not just SMA, but we weren't able to go.
You mean like a social gathering?
Yeah, it was a social gathering. Unfortunately, it conflicted with some other stuff we had, but they're going to do it again. And there's talk of, they're talking about bringing together sort of the first cohort from UVA of the kids treated with SMA later in the summer.
With a Spinraza.
Spinraza, right. And so I hope that will happen, because I would love to spend some more time with the kids. And the kids are coming from all over. Some of them are from Virginia, but some of them are coming from some other places too. I know one from South Carolina, for example. So we have at least the parents have met, and so I'm I'm Facebook friends with the local parents, and you get the name, and then you search online, and then you figure out, okay, they're friends with a bunch of my other friends who have SMA, so it's probably the right person, and and you connect that way. I have some folks in town who have kids who have different other complicated special needs, and I rely on them too when I'm having a bad day, or when we're having to do suction or some horrible treatment and I'm panicking. And so we have some support there too for the other families in Charlottesville that have kids with complex medical needs.
So you talked about the treatments that Bennett is going through at home, that 8 hours a day, the vest and the special breathing and the leg braces. Let me ask that. Is all that equipment at home? Do you do all that in home?
We do. We debate maybe bringing it to school for some of the day, because it takes up so much of the day. But, the equipment is fairly expensive, and insurance companies don't usually pay for you to have multiple copies of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
like his power wheelchair, we only bring home on the weekends, and we mostly have that just at school.
So you keep it at school.
Mm-hmm.
So let's roll back a little bit. Let's just talk about Bennett now. He's in school.
He's in school, and he's in, the Charlottesville City Schools have been very supportive.
He's in our neighborhood school.
He's in our neighborhood school.
Johnson Elementary, where my kids went to school. Where your daughter, is your daughter still there?
She graduates next week, yes. And that was another thing. He could have gone to another city school in a special needs preschool program last year. And we all talked about it and decided it was best for Bennett to be in the neighborhood school. And
mm-hmm.
so they worked out a way so that he was, even though based on his diagnosis, he might have been a better fit somewhere else. They figured out a way. The school system has been incredibly supportive. And there's lots of discussions about, this is unprecedented. And then the response back is, well, Bennett's condition is unprecedented.
Right.
And, I can't say anything but positive things about the medical community, about the educational community, that people are really doing everything they can to integrate Bennett into the regular classroom. And that's been amazing. He's such a social creature. I have some friends who have kids with SMA, and they homeschool them because they don't want to expose them to germs. And I totally respect and understand that, because Bennett spends most of the winter sick, quite frankly. But for Bennett, we made a decision early on that because he is such a social creature, we wanted to focus on his quality of life rather than the quantity of his life.
Of course.
And for him, to keep him out of school, like from October to April, which is a time of year that my husband and I we sometimes call it death watch when it's really bad, because it can be. But to keep him out of school because we are afraid of him getting sick, it just doesn't make any sense. Like, he needs to be with people. He needs to be surrounded by kids his age, and he needs to be interacting with them. That's what he's meant to do. And so we're going to do that's what we're going to focus on. We're going to give him the kind of life that allows him to live his life to the fullest.
So a few weeks ago, he had a birthday party.
He did.
Was it Guardians of the Galaxy thing?
It was. It was a Guardians of the Galaxy birthday party. He fell in love with Baby Groot, so it was a Baby Groot-themed party.
Sure. And friends from the school came over. How has his social connections been now?
It's not the same as our daughter. Our daughter gets invited to play dates, and in a way, Bennett doesn't get invited as often. There are a few that try. In fact, he's got a birthday party next weekend, and this little girl, she actually last year changed her party venue so that Bennett could attend, because she realized that he couldn't go do what the other kids were doing. They wouldn't allow him there. And she was like, well, Mom, that's not right. We have to find a place where Bennett can be.
That's very nice.
So while he doesn't have the same level of interaction that his sister had at this age, he has amazing friends. You know, kids love him.
Mm-hmm.
And he loves kids, young ladies especially. He mostly is friends with little girls and teenage girls, for that matter.
Sure.
They help take
sure.
care of him. He's
sure.
he's quite the ladies' man.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has this amazing social network, and the great thing about little kids is that they don't notice difference the same way that grown-ups do.
Mm-hmm.
And so they accept him for who he is, and Johnson actually is a great school for that. Bennett's not the only one who attends there who has some pretty complex medical needs, and the kids, they love them. They just love them, and that, I think, is a testament to the teachers and the administration there as much as the kids themselves.
So we've got about a minute left. I want to give you the chance to give a shout out to whomever or whatever that you want to give your attaboy to whether it's schools or the hospitals or somebody you haven't mentioned yet.
Wow, that's a long list.
And you have about 30 seconds.
I think everybody who knows us, everybody who comes in contact with Bennett, realizes what a delight he is, and they are amazing. They bring us food when he's in the hospital. Mm-hmm. They work to make sure he can be integrated in the classrooms there. They work overtime at the hospital in order to keep him safe and to get what he needs. And like that's how we're able to do this. This is really hard, but that's how we're able to do it, is because we've got this amazing community.
My guest and friend and neighbor and co-worker, Kara McClurkin, talking about her family and her son and SMA, spinal muscular atrophy. Thank you so much. I know you were concerned about coming in about this, but this is an important topic, and I hope that people listening have learned a lot. I know that they have, and when we post the podcast on Seville Podcast, we'll include some links to Cure SMA and other places that you might suggest. Thank you so much for coming in, Dan. Thank you, my producer, for sitting behind me and pushing buttons and tapping me on the shoulder and telling me when to stop talking. This is Sean McCord. You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.